Hello and welcome to From the Vault, where we highlight Cynic podcasts, Cynic feature podcasts that you may not be aware of or know about. Today we look back at Celtic versus Valencia in the UEFA Cup from 2001. It's a game that was 22 years ago yesterday. It took place on the 6th of December 2001, and we just wanted to highlight this because it's a really good feature podcast, but also, you know, with everything to do with atmosphere around the ground just now, this is, you know, we talk about it on the podcast, but this is one of the best atmospheres we've ever experienced at Celtic Park in contemporary times. So we wanted to let you hear it, make your own mind up, and, you know, reminisce about glory days at Celtic Park. Should point out that the podcast was recorded on March 28th, 2021. So, you know, stylistically, there's some difference and also maybe differences in sound, but it's still a great podcast to listen to. And we go through pretty much the whole process of the game itself, as well as the lay of the land regarding squad and the team and everything. So have a listen, enjoy, and yeah, let us know your feedback. Hello and welcome to Focus On. I'm your host, Christopher Gallagher. And today we are going to focus on a match, a specific match that I have been thinking about a lot since everything's happened with Celtic in Europe this season. It's a match I always go back to. It's one of my favourite ever Celtic matches. Celtic versus Valencia from the 6th of December 2001. That's the game we're going to focus on today. I've got a great panel. Christopher Sermani. Hello, Christopher. How are you?
Hello, Christopher. I'm very well. I'm looking forward to this today. This was a classic. It's one of the games that you mention and you think about. And even though, not spoilers, it maybe isn't the happiest of happy endings, you still, you know, it doesn't matter as much when everything was put into this game. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Lovely stuff. Barry Gallagher. Hello, Barry.
Hi, Chris. Much the same as Sermani. I probably reference this point throughout the pod, but I think this is widely regarded as the best atmosphere at the new Celtic Park. And I think it had everything. It was a real joy watching the full game back. And this was without doubt the best Celtic team of my lifetime, and so many great memories. So it's a good time to talk about it, I think.
Interesting that you say that, and we'll come on to that in terms of greatest Celtic team from this sort of era, but we'll come back to that at some point. Alan Edgar, hello Alan, how are you, sir?
Good, thank you. I enjoyed my homework for this one. This was really a real treat to watch. The only way I can describe it is a proper game of football.
Great. And it's funny. I
know. Okay. That was it, sorry.
Yeah, I hope you're going to say a bit more. I hope you're going to say a bit more. This will be a very short podcast.
This was great, and that's it. Moving on. You say that, and I know, obviously, this is, for me, the greatest, it's hard to say, the greatest display. It's obviously, the result doesn't go our way, spoilers, as we say, but just the display from Celtic, specifically in the first half year, specifically in the first 25, 30 minutes, is, I'm going to say it, it's absolutely sensational. It's just some of the most incredible, but you know what, we'll focus on it. Right, so let's do that. Celtic 2001-2002. So the game took place on the 6th of December 2001. This is after we came out of, obviously, our first Champions League group stage performance. We're going to touch on that briefly. But the game takes place in December. I thought it was January, but that's my mind playing tricks on me, because obviously in today's games, if you drop out the Champions League, the ties take place in the new year. So, you know, we can touch on how it was a different football and landscape at that point of view. I just want to set the scene. So Martin O'Neill comes in 2001. Sermani, you can kind of start us off there. Set the scene about what O'Neill did in that first season that brought us into this second season.
He changed, revolutionised the mindset of the football club at that time. I mean, you know, I'm sure there'll be a kind of go-to bunch of cliches that we'll use today, but being a Celtic fan in the '90s. Basically, you know, guys our age had grown up with Celtic being second best in Scotland. And Europe was an absolute no-go zone. I mean, I've referenced this many a time before. In the '90s, you used to get a fixture card, and it used to print the UEFA Cup tie dates all the way up to the final, which was two-legged in those days, of course. And I just remember thinking, why the fuck have the club put that on the fixtures? Because we'll be out in the first or second round. You know, barring the odd outlier, you know, perhaps the Cologne home game or whatever, Europe was something that we had to get out of the way before we got the disappointment of domestic action out of the way. But Anil changed absolutely everything. He changed how we saw ourselves as a football club. I mean, guys older than us probably maybe didn't have this ingrained in them, but we did. When we were growing up, it was heartache, but it all changed in 2000. When he came in, very quickly, with a 6-2 game, he just put down a marker, and we were just, it just changed the way we thought of ourselves as a club, and it set us up basically for, what is it, since he came in, 15 out of 21 league titles we've won. So he basically flipped the switch. We are the dominant force in Scottish football, and Martin O'Neill needs to take a lot of credit for that. So it's hard to describe in words what Martin O'Neill did in terms of the future of the football club. So that was a great time to be a Celtic fan, especially as at that age I was, you know, we were just able to start, you know, at the pub for pints and stuff, and it coincided with us. That was phenomenal for me.
Yeah, I think the timing of us growing up and this happening really, it just cements it right in your brain. There's always that period that I'm sure every fan has at every kind of era and time. And this is, Barry, this is like our peak, you know, not specifically this season or this, you know, small period, but just the O'Neill years are pretty much the definitive years for us.
Definitely. So Manny mentioned there about how O'Neill sort of revolutionised the club. He also changed the mindset of supporters. It's funny, I always remember when I was maybe 10, 11, I used to go over to Donegal in the summer, and one of my dad's cousins, because I was tall, I used to say, you need to stand tall, because he said, your shoulders are slipped, you're walking like a Celtic fan. And that's always stuck in my mind, because he said it's when people come back from Celtic Park, they were always sloped over because of how bad the 90s were. And when he flipped that, he made you walk tall, shoulders back, be proud to be a Celtic fan. And that's that Samani said there. Won so many titles since, and it just completely changed it. And he'll have a pivotal role. His place in history is cemented, I think, because of the turnaround. If you think how low we had been 6 months, even less than that, before he came in, and how quickly he turned it around is something that I think maybe younger fans wouldn't know. Like, within a few months, we were really coming into form, and it just seemed like riding the crest of a wave at that time. Like, you had no fear, no matter the opposition. As we'll come on to, when this draw was made, obviously on the back of the Champions League group, which we were unlucky in, I remember going into it thinking we had a really good chance, and that was sort of unheard of in the backdrop of what Sir Manny said in the 90s, because you used to get like drawn with Hamburg and stuff like that, and you were just thinking, oh well, it might be a nice night out, but that'll be the end of it. And you started to dream that you could go deeper into competitions, and that was unheard of. So it was a great time, as somebody says.
Alan, Edgar, you know, Martin O'Neill comes in, and I remember specifically, like, what before a ball was kicked, it was like, what do we want O'Neill to do here? And essentially, in that first season, we just wanted to get as close to Rangers as we could. I mean, people forget that. We just wanted to get as close to them as we could, because obviously the Barnes season was an absolute disaster. But O'Neill comes in and sweeps the boards. And it just set us up for the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, talk us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the boys have covered it really well. I think, you know, the idea, you think where we were partless. We had some really good players, but we didn't have a style, you didn't have a way of playing. It was just, you know, it was so disparate. But O'Neill comes in, and it's not even a case of finding his way in to, you know, and feeling your way around and trying to tinker with things and maybe try a couple. He came in, this is what I'm going to do. We recruited players for it. And the 6-2 game, it's not so much then, it wasn't a warning shot to Rangers. It was a knockout blow in August. And it just, I think it immediately changed everybody's perceptions. You know, I don't remember any Celtic success really prior to Martin O'Neill. You know, stopping the 10 was massive. You know, Scottish Cup 95, I very, very, very vaguely remember. But right away, Martin O'Neill came in that first season, what he achieved, it just made you think what was possible with, if you bring a good coach in, you get the right type of players around him, you know, around a manager. And I think the boys are right. It changed the nature of what you thought being a Celtic fan could be. It never occurred to me in my, you know, time growing up as a Celtic fan that you could ever come in and sweep the boards in a single season. That wasn't something that, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just speaking personally or for myself here, but it was never possible. It never seemed possible that you could win a treble. That was never in the cards. You might win the two cups, but the idea of doing it all and competing in Europe was just a completely alien concept. And, you know, there was flaws, you know, it would fall by the wayside in some times, but it was possible. And he did it in his first season. And it's incredible. And it's become a little bit more common now in the last few years, but it was new ground was broken by Martin O'Neill, I think.
Let's have a look at the squad. So this season, this is Martin O'Neill's second season. So we're not quite at the Seville squad, but because guys like Jonathan Gould still there. Guys like, Momo Sylla was brought in. In fact, let me just talk you through the players that were brought in. John Hartson, Bobo Baldy, Momo Sylla, and Steve Guppy for a total combined of £7 million for four players. Baldy was a free. That was a kind of wrangling. Obviously, that adds to Rab Douglas had came in the season before. You've obviously got Henrik Larsson. Morten Wieghorst, he was kind of coming back from injury. Mialbi was there. Valharin. Tom Boyd was still there. He was in the squad more than anything. You got Lubo Moravcik as well, who obviously was coming to the end of his time, but still incredible. Sutton, Thompson. Players who left: Alan Stubbs, Tommy Johnson, Stefan Mahi, Mark Burchill, and Ayo Berkovic. Berkovic left for £1.5 million. Now, considering we paid £5.5-6 million quid for him, which blew our transfer budget away under Barnes, that's quite a drop. What did you make of this squad, Barry? What was your, you know, you mentioned earlier, and this is what I wanted to bring up. You know, not this season, but this, you know, the season after Celtic get to UEFA Cup final. This squad's not quite there, but how good was this squad?
I think when I kind of said that earlier, I meant similar to what you were saying about, I meant kind of the O'Neill era. I know the squad was sort of ever-changing, but the bulk of the players that were in the squad this season, I know there was a couple of additions here or there, was without doubt, I think, the strongest squad. The strongest, maybe not squad, because I've made the point earlier this season about this season's squad is a 1-20, maybe been quite strong, but a core of 14, 15 players, this was as good as it would get for me as a Celtic fan. It's funny you mentioned we paraded Hearts and Sylla and Guppy on the same day, I remember. That was quite a early 2000s, late 90s thing to do. You put all your players together at once. I quite liked that, so maybe bring that back. But it shows you the strength that we had in that squad. If we had possibly one of our greatest ever strike partnerships of Larsson and Sutton, and then we had a £6 million John Hartson from the Premiership. We were filled with international players, and the likes of Baldy coming in, I know he replaced Vega, who never took up the option for his deal from the season before, and you had a core of good Scottish players. Lambert was at his peak, McNamara was at his peak. So a really good squad, and a squad that was kind of front-loaded the first couple of seasons. We never really added anyone in sort of monetary value in the rest of the O'Neill era, which was probably to our detriment. But this squad here was the sort of creme de la creme.
That's a good point that Barry makes, Sirmani, about the fact that everything was kind of front-loaded with O'Neill. Obviously, that kind of comes back to kind of bite us on the arse, but we were spending incredible amounts of money. You know, Hartson, Sutton, you know, even guys like Thompson. Thompson was £3.5 million. It was a lot of money, and it's money we'd never seen before and haven't really seen like that short of period of time since.
Yeah, and we started this pod talking about the change in mindset very quickly how easily you settle into that mindset. And obviously, I remember at the time thinking, Mravchik had come in and made such a massive impact, but really I think he'd played his football for us after the first treble season. After Emile's first season, I think you could see that Lubo's legs were on the wane. We never replaced Lubo. I mean, how could you replace Lubo? But I always remember we never had that bit of magic. I think Emile's team was like a tour de force. They would batter you, you know, they were workmanlike, you know, they were hard, they were strong. But we never had a player really like that. Now, obviously, Larson could produce that, but I'm talking about somebody who's not a goal scorer, an out-and-out creator. We were linked with Hakim Yakin, you know, linked to, I mean, we could go through a lot of players we were linked with. But there was always, the thing about this team is, you look back on them so fondly, and yet you think, when you talk about it as a squad, I think as a first 11, I think there was a lot of talent in there. But see, when you bring in guys like Silla, bringing in guys like David Fernandez in years, players like this whereby we couldn't keep up that financial kind of spend, and we had to supplement it with this might work or this might not work. Pros that, you know, going further forward, Stefan Honcho, guys who had played at a level but were coming to the end of it. It frustrates me, and it feels weird saying this because we talk about it so fondly, because you just think, see, if we had an extra few bob, what could we have done to kind of, I mean, forward then on to Seville. I mean, Ulrik Larsson was playing there. Ulrik Larsson wasn't the worst player, but he was a step down from when we were bringing in Sutton, Lennon, all these guys in the first season. So there's a wee taste of what if we could have kind of sprinkled a little bit more quality on this era's team, because although we kind of smashed it domestically, I don't know. Dare we dream? How far could we have gone in some of these competitions? But that's just because after Anil came in, I became a greedy bastard, and not alone there, you know.
The other thing as well, when we're talking about these players, the one thing that's missing from that's entirely different now than it was in 2001 is that all the guys that Martin Neil brought in, they weren't brought in for future resale. These guys were brought in to work at Celtic. And every, you know, I'm just off the top of my head, there was only one player that was brought in that really provided a profit, and it wasn't Martin Neil that signed him, it was Stan Petrov. Other than that, all these guys played their best football at Celtic and then waned a little towards the end. So we gave guys maybe 3-4 year deals, and the first 2-3 years, great, real success. But then there was that kind of last year where you were never going to move them on, there wasn't really proper interest. And that's the big difference from now. When we sign a player now, it's, well, he might be worth XYZ. We don't buy players that are 26, 27 and at their peak. You know, generally, it's always who can we move on? And that was the one thing. Martin Neil was never able to bring in money so that he could then say, well, I've brought in 12 million for this player, so how much am I getting? It was all, you know, expenditure. There was no real income. And, you know, I think that's maybe what, you know, in that last kind of two years, what really probably cost us in terms of that development, because the money from the UEFA Cup run, etc., it's nothing compared to what was going out, as you say, when you talk about some of the figures in terms of wages and, you know, transfer fees.
We defeat Ajax in the qualifier. We've discussed that at length, and it's just probably one of the most important results in our contemporary history, because it leads us into the Champions League. We win home games in the Champions League. We lose away games in the Champions League. We finish on 9 points. We win all our home games, as we mentioned. Obviously, that thrilling 4-3 game against Juventus is in there as well. Really disappointing performances, and specifically in Trondheim. You know, just to kind of put a little bit of context in from a European standpoint, I don't know, some people might not know this if you're a little bit younger, there was two group stages. So you don't qualify for the last 16 from this point of view. You qualify for a second group stage. And then after that, it goes to the quarters and stuff. Just the landscape of European football at this point was a little bizarre. And that's why I bring up the fact that the tie was in November. Because obviously now, you drop out of the Champions League, and you know it's in, you're into the new year. But I just want to highlight Celtic's form coming into this, because this is actually, I've just been looking at it. So from the 10th of October until the 9th of December, the Valencia game is on the 6th of December, but we had a game on the 9th of December. So that's 2 months. Celtic play 15 games. A lot of games in a very, very short period of time. We drop out of the Champions League, unfortunately. As I mentioned, Celtic had 9 points. Arsenal and Roma both went through with 9 points. Boa Vista went through with 8 points. It was just one of those, bastard. But we dropped through. I know, that was weird. I don't know why I said that with that. Bastard.
I'm sure.
Very Partridge.
Oh, shucks, we've not made it.
but we're drawn with Valencia. Let's put Valencia in context. Valencia, the two seasons before, so I'm just going to bring it back 2 years. Hector Cooper was the manager, 1999-2000. They finished third in Spain. They get to the final of the Champions League. They scud Lazio and Barcelona. But then in the final against Real Madrid, they lose 3-0. Steve McManaman scores a bicycle kick. It's incredible. But they got to that Champions League final. Then the next season, they got to the Champions League final again. They beat Arsenal, they beat Leeds, and then they lose to Bayern Munich on penalties. And then the season after that, that's when we draw them. Barry, do you remember when we drew Valencia? What was your kind of thought process at that time?
I think. You were thinking after being sort of felt hard done to, as you say, getting 9 points and not going through, and you were hoping to go a wee bit of a run on this, and then you pull Valencia. And Valencia at that time were a great team to watch. I think they'd kind of been raided by sort of the big guns in Europe. I think of like Mendieta going to Lazio and
Claudio Lopez
as well. And I don't know if any can remember, but remember they played Rangers 99 in the Champions League, and I think they'd started their domestic season really poorly. And I'm sure the Scottish press called them the Aberdeen of Spain.
Even specifically.
Aberdeen of Spain, mental. But they were household names. You could rhyme off their 1-11. Canizares stood out because of the sort of bleach blonde hair. And you were just feeling the worst. Because you were wondering if we'd maybe run ourselves into the ground a wee bit with the Champions League campaign, because it was such high intensity. But you were just hoping that for one, we could maybe find the same level of form that we had in both Juventus games. Because I don't think Valencia, with the players who had gone out, weren't quite at the level of Juventus. So dreading it in a way, but also optimistic. So it was kind of a mixed bag.
Rafa Benitez was the manager of Valencia when we draw them. He's under pressure. What was your take, Chris, to the when we drew Valencia?
Stinking draw. I remember thinking, you know, Barry said it earlier on, that was a tough group we got, because, I mean, Rosenberg, even then, Rosenberg were known as punching above their weight for several seasons, had got results in Madrid and were regular features in the Champions League. Yeah. So they were perceived as the weakest team that we played, but they were still a strong side. So then to go into the UEFA Cup after that, that was a stinker. So I'd been looking for something a bit easier, perhaps, you know, just kind of tick us over sort of thing. So my first thing wasn't so much about whether we would win or lose it. It was that we'd got a tough draw and that we maybe deserved an easier time. After that, I think by then the mindset had been, the one that changed my mindset was the 2-each in Turin. 2-each, the 3-2. It was nearly
2-each.
It's 2-each in my head, right? So the defeat in Turin. Because see, when we came back in that second half after being down and out, I went, oh, wait a minute, there's a mindset here, right? So I didn't ever go into games thinking we would win, but I thought that we could. And I think I thought that about Valencia. This is tough, but if we can avoid a smashing over in Spain, we've got a chance here, as around that time was always the case.
Yeah, Alan, your thoughts on Valencia? Tough opposition, tough prospect.
Yeah, I don't remember the draw particularly, but I would echo exactly what Barry said. I think, you know, the ages kind of we were all at, you know, teenagers or maybe, you know, around that era, you knew teams in Europe. You know, I think we were talking about this again fairly recently. There was a time when you could, you know, as Barry says, name the 1 to 11, I say the top 10, 12, 13 sides in Europe quite comfortably. I don't know whether that's Champ Manager or FIFA or whatever it was at the time, or just you're eager for knowledge. But some of the names that you've mentioned, Valencia were a top side, you know, a really, really incredible team. And to draw them, it's an emotion that we would experience a lot in terms of, I've always loved the Champions League draw. See, when you, I think one of the great things about making the Champions League, obviously there's the lucrative financial side, but in terms of a fan, I've always made time. You know, I remember being at uni and going down to, I think it was Maggie Mays or whatever. I've always done it. You'd always go and watch the draw at lunchtime. I think it's different now because you can watch it on your phone, but you used to have to watch it in Sky Sports News. And I've always loved the draw. You know, it's UEFA Cup, maybe a wee bit different, you know, apart from the Seville season, but it's one of those magical things. And every single time, though, you get up for it and you're looking forward to it and you leave thinking, that's not really what I was hoping for. There was a time when I did like the glamour draws. I'm probably a wee bit different. That's only in the last maybe 4 or 5 years that the glamour thing is completely, I don't enjoy it anymore because it's, I think it's just beyond the realms of possibility now. But I think around this time I did quite like the glamour draws because it felt like once you were in the group stage, it felt like you were in the club. That was it. Getting through was obviously the aim, but getting the draw was what it's all about, you know, going to the San Siro. I think it's easy when you've had these glamour draws to then say you don't want them anymore. But when you've never had them, you've never had the chance to go and see Celtic in the San Siro, the Nou Camp. I think then, you know, I think the one that people think about and still think about to this day is that, I mean, it would be horrible to watch, but I think everybody would love us to draw Real Madrid. Everybody would love that opportunity maybe to get to the Bernabeu and, you know, be sat up in the gods watching the game. And it would be horrible, but it's one of the ones I think we'd like to tick off.
Yeah.
It's easy when you've done it to say you don't want it anymore. But if we were sitting here now having never played some of these teams in Europe, we would be yearning for it, I think.
Just to run through some of these names in terms of the squad for the Valencia had, you had Canizares in goals, who, in my opinion, was one of the best goalkeepers in the world at that point. He'd is obviously bleached blonde hair, and he was a bit unhinged at points. But think of these names. Pellegrino, Roberto Ayala was, in my opinion at that point, probably the best defender in the world, or at least he's certainly in the top five or six. He was magnificent. He was small, but he was great. Even Jocelyn Angloma, who, you know, was at Marseille, he was part of that Marseille team that won the Champions League. He was really old at this point, but he was still really, really good and still really, really fast. Marchena, Torres. From a midfielder perspective, you've got David Albelda, you've got Kili Gonzalez, Baraja, Angulo, Aymar, who, you know, one of the great creative number 10s in European football, Vicente. And then up front, you've got Adrian Illy, Juan Sanchez, John Carew, and Mista Salva. This is levels above. You know, it's Champions League quality, Chris. I think that's the point. We came out of the Champions League, we drop into the UEFA Cup, you think to yourself, right, let's get a bit of a more even tie, and we get a Champions League team, essentially.
Totally. I mean, they'd proven in the two seasons before what level they were at and where we are. And I know they had a slight run on them in terms of some of the bigger players that they had. But they filled them with players that maybe not of equal stature, but certainly not, you know, the standards weren't plummeting with the players that they replaced them with. So, yeah, you knew you were up against it. I mean, you're just going through some of those names there. And you're just thinking about having seen them play. And even, you mentioned Angloma, guys like that, you know, names you've forgotten about and he's on the bench for them and things. That was a very, very good side full of quality football players. So I don't think anybody was under any illusion, you know. I mean, for instance, see if we fast forward to 2013 when we drew Juventus in the last 16. And people who had maybe not watched Football Italia since James Richardson was on Channel 4 were talking about, you know, Juventus not being the team that they were, and they were promptly scudded 5-0. There was no room for that ignorance when it came to Valencia for what they had done for the three seasons before. So I think when that name came out of the hat, every Celtic fan went, shit.
Yeah, pretty much. Alan?
Just now that we are kind of talking about Valencia as well, obviously, I probably should have looked at this before we started recording, but their significant financial troubles that they would have, you know, a decade later,
yeah,
slightly less, slightly more. I presume that they were investing heavily in that squad as well, because they managed to keep a lot of those guys as well. You talk about the guys that left, but they did keep a lot of these guys. These guys were at their peak, so you would be paying a lot more in wages. You would be investing a lot. And I presume that this was contributed in some part to that, you know, severe financial trouble they had. I mean, that is a club that would, again, you know, was essentially on the brink as well.
Basically, their financial trouble came from the fact that they had a training facility that was worth a lot of money. But after 2008, the crash, it kind of, you know, it turned out there was a lot of debt kind of saddled towards it, and basically it became not worthless, but the value of it dropped a significant amount to the point where they were running at negative equity in terms of what the stadium and the facilities. I don't know that much about it, but I know that was the kind of key aspect, because they were on the verge of moving, and then after the crash, it turned out that they didn't have as much money as they thought they would. We play our last game in the Champions League on the 31st of October, Halloween, and then the game at the Mestalla, 22nd of November. So, really short turnaround time in terms of the next rounds of the UEFA Cup. The Mestalla was, at that point, one of the most intimidating stadiums in European football for a number of reasons. One of the main reasons was they were undefeated for a long time at that stadium. It was quite a sheer stadium in terms of the way it kind of angled up. It was quite an intimidating stadium. So, Celtic are going into this game. In fact, this is, yeah, we'll just start with the home tie. We're drawing away first. That suit is better, Barry, you think? Away first, you try and kind of not concede as many. We'll deal with them at home. That was my way of thinking. Was that your way of thinking as well?
Yeah, I think that was the sort of mindset then, that you would go away and then, for want of a better phrase, you could mop up or you could try and fix the result at Celtic Park. But as you say, I was lucky enough to go to the Mestalla in 2019, and it's just like a fantastic arena. It was pretty intimidating, but that's for another. That was the hands of the local constabulary. Just going there, and I remember this game. It wasn't on TV, I'm almost certain. And even at that point, that was quite unheard of. I think at that point, the teams negotiated their own TV deals, because I remember German clubs could make a fortune out of UEFA Cup ties because of the rights, and it meant that you could sometimes play crazy kickoff times. I'm sure when we played Hamburg a few years earlier that it was like a 5 o'clock kickoff because it was at the hands of the clubs to decide. So that was quite unusual. I remember listening to the game on the radio, and I think the fact that you knew that you weren't going to see it just adds to the nerves. I think other people will know what I mean by that, because at least if you're watching it, you can see what's happening. But I always think if you're listening on the radio, any time the opposition team are in your half, you're fearing the worst. And when you watch the game, you know it's not that dangerous. So going into this game, and one point I'd made in my notes, and it comes back to the point that I'd made about injuries and the strength of the squad. The game before this, we played Hearts away, and I don't know if any of you remember the horrendous challenge by Andy Webster on a gap. It was like a knee-high challenge and horrendous tackle. And it's similar to, I think one of the pods I was listening to this week was talking about when Ezaguirre got that injury. He was never really the same. And I think you could argue a gap was like that. But at that point in time, you were thinking how effective a gap had been for us in the Champions League. I think that away to Juve, at home to Juventus, it was just that blistering pace. And he gave O'Neill's side something that no one else could really offer. So going into this game, that heavily impacted on the way that we would line up. And just, I've got a team here in front of me, Gal, before you come on to it, a complete change in system from what we had seen from O'Neill before. And it goes back to that point that Samani was saying about lacking squad depth, I think.
Yeah, I watched this game at the Beanback. We went to a Beanback. Me and my sister went to Beanback at Celtic Park. So we got to actually see it. Weird atmosphere at a Beanback, just because... you're not actually sitting that close. You're not sitting as in a crowd. It's kind of a bit sparse, and you know, there's a bit of a delay, and it was weird. But we were happy to get to see the game anyway. Chris, this tie, you see the team lineup. Celtic have been playing mainly three at the back, and then we go to this game. We've got no Chris Sutton because of a family illness. We've got no Alan Thompson. We've got no Yusuf Harin, and we've got no Agat. What are you feeling when you hear these players aren't involved?
I didn't watch the game. Well, it wasn't on TV. I didn't go to the Beanback. I think I was out at a gig, believe it or not. I didn't even listen to it on the radio. Part of the reason that kind of spurred me to go out was I thought we're in trouble here because we had to plug a lot of gaps. My abiding memory of it is, do you remember you used to be able to send a text message to get the score on your back before you had like the internet on it?
WAP.
Aye, WAP, is that what you called it? Aye. So text Celtic to 8408 or something like that, and it would come back with the score and stuff. And I remember kind of doing that a couple of times, and then I text my dad or my mate or whatever, and they were saying that Douglas had an absolute blunder. I seen some of the highlights. There would have been limited highlights the next night or whatever or something like that. So I remember watching them, and it just seemed to me to be a continual wave after wave of attacks on Rab Douglas at the time. It was one of those ones where I was checking my phone every 2 minutes trying to find out what the score was. You know, see, when you do go out and Celtic are playing, it's a waste. You know, it doesn't happen very often now because you can see them, but any time that has happened to me, it's a total waste of time because you're not concentrating on what you're out for. You're just looking at your phone, and I remember that being one of those other nights. Just, it's still 0-0. It's still 0-0. But, you know, any reports I got was just about how Rab Douglas had turned into this colossus of a goalkeeper for one night.
Yeah, so we're in Mestalla. The lineup, and get your thoughts on this, Alan. Mialbi, Baldy, Craney, McNamara. So Stephen Craney's in at left back, McNamara's at right back. You get Mialbi and Baldy's your centre halves. Lambert, Lennon, Moravchik and Petrov as your four. And then you've got Larsson and Hartson up front. Hartson was in and out of the team at that point because obviously Larsson and Sutton were just one of the greatest partnerships we've ever seen. So he's finding it hard, but he starts this game. As I say, no Sutton, no Thompson, no Valharan, no Agat. We go into this game. What's your memories of the game, Alan?
Very sparse as well. I'm sure there was highlights on later on the same night. I don't know whether it would have been on
BBC, I think.
BBC or whatever. But I do, you know, it was... I think going into it, when you've seen that team and when you think about it, it was about keeping the tie alive. I think that's really what it's about. It's, you know, accepting that, you know, it's going to be very difficult, but you still got to remember, I think when you had Henrik Larsson in your team, you always thought you could do something. And I think that's something that other teams would also be aware of as well, because he's not at his peak probably at this point. You know, that's still to come. But I think everybody would have been aware that he was a genuinely world-class striker. So having that always gives you the threat. But realistically, it's just about getting it back to Celtic Park so it's a competitive match. And I don't mean to be... I don't think with an O'Neill team at this point you ever felt you weren't going to lose 4-5-0. I didn't feel that was the case. But if you go there and, you know, you lose a couple of goals, you lose 2-0, then it's going to be extremely difficult at home. And it's difficult now to maybe think, but Rab Douglas at this time... This would probably be his best ever performance in a Celtic shirt. I think that goes probably without saying. But I'm trying to think at that time whether, and maybe you guys can help a little bit, but is he the type of goalkeeper at that time that we thought after this performance that this is the guy for the next 2 or 3 years? Or was it an outlier in terms of performance? Was it he's just had an absolutely incredible night, which he did? I mean, you know, you can go and see the saves yourself. The save from John Carew's just outstanding. It's world class. And he would have a very good game in the home leg as well, it has to be said. But was this just an outlier, or did you think this is his moment now and he is kind of, you know, the undisputed number 20, as it were.
Sir Manny, you can bring you in first.
No. No. Nah, Douglas is one of the first players that come to my mind when I talk about the extra sprinkle and equality we could have had. Douglas, maybe not fair. See if we'd had a goalkeeper. See if we'd had Boric under a nail. Well, there you go. Right. And for me, Douglas was always just, he was better than Gould, you know. He was a step up from where we had been. But I think that just shows you how bad some of the keepers that we'd had up to that point were. For me, Douglas was a very flawed individual who could, on occasion, have a great shot-stopping performance, which is what he did in the Mestalla. But fundamentally, all round, no. I never thought this was the birth of the Celtic number 20, as you say.
We would have problems with goalkeepers from Douglas up until Boric. You know, we'd bring in Magnus Hedman, you know, Javier Sanchez Broto would come in for a brief spell. You know, like, Barry, I mean, you would agree that Douglas never really convinced us that he was that wall that we needed for games, funnily enough, like this, even though he excels in this game.
I think the reason that maybe this was the perfect type of game for Douglas, because we signed him on the back of the fact that we were firing shots in at him. We signed him on his performances against us, is what I'm trying to say, because as a shot stopper, he was fairly decent. But I think that Douglas is sort of burnt his bridges on that 5-1 game. I wonder if we'll ever do a pod about that, Alan, at Ibrox. And I don't think he was ever going to recapture the goodwill of the Celtic fans after that. I think his mind was made up. Our minds were made up on him. He wasn't the best at coming for crosses, and he just didn't really instill confidence. But to give him his due, I think, as Alan said, if you asked any Celtic fan, sort of our age or older, what was his defining moment, and it would always be the Mestalla in 2001.
Our goals peppered, absolutely peppered with shots consistently for the 90 minutes. However, and I do remember this really, really vividly, and I remember this sequence, but I actually couldn't remember what game it was. Petrov bursts through one-on-one with Canizares and he scuffs his shot, and it's a huge moment in the tie overall, but it's specifically a huge moment in this game because it's the 25th minute. It's one of those where we've had 25 minutes where we've been camped out in our own 6-yard line, but he breaks through and it makes you think, ah, okay, if he just has that touch better, you know, we could have kind of got away. But essentially, this is a, you know, situation where, Alan, it's just a case of defend, because we need to take something back to Celtic Park.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think if I remember right, I had a quick glance before we started recording, but losing 1-0 seemed like a victory because of the manner of it. At 1-0 down, you know, obviously there's that, you always want to score a goal, but at 1-0 down, you're very much in this tie, because I think the mindset of it is very quickly would have been the circumstances of the game dictated that if you can keep them to a goal, then you can do, as Barry says, you can mop up or do the tidying up at Celtic Park, because it's going to be very, very different. And even at this time, even though it's very early in terms of that rebirth in Europe, you are aware that at Celtic Park, the circumstances might be completely different. You know, you've mentioned the steep, you know, stands at the Mestalla and how intimidating it would be. But we knew what Celtic Park could offer. I don't think we probably knew quite how much Celtic Park could offer, and we'll get to that. But you knew that losing 1-0, you were still in the tie very much. You had a lot of quality, maybe a couple of players coming back as well, guys like Sutton, guys like Vilharen, and you can think, well, if we keep it to 1-0 and perform like that, then maybe at Celtic Park, you know, we are still on the tie. So I did feel very much after it, and you know, the newspaper reports seem to confirm that this was seen as you've managed to escape here, and you're still in it, and that's very much a win almost.
Barry,
see, just on that as well, like the sort of mindset that it felt almost like a win. I think the circumstances as well, that it was just before we flew out, or I think maybe Sutton had to fly back, didn't he? Because his young son
yeah.
was really ill, and I know Sutton speaks about that frequently. The sort of the care and how the nurses and doctors saved his son's life. The fact that his son was able to get better and have him back for the second leg with Phil Harran, you were thinking that to manage to get a result in that sort of against the magnitude of a team like Valencia and in that stadium when you were depleted both through injury and through sort of personal tragedy almost, it gave you that sort of fight that we could take the game to them on our own patch.
Chris, we hold on to the 78th minute. Douglas makes some incredible saves. Celtic have the odd chance. There's one or two chances that we have, but nothing really concrete. But we concede, we hold on to the 78th minute. You know, Pablo Aimar is pulling the strings. He's finding spaces. He's finding pockets. It's hard to pin him down. You've got Angulo, who I always found was a really... He was tall, he was quite lanky, but he was quite powerful. He was a hard guy to mark or to... You know, the way he kind of moved was really kind of unique. And obviously you've got Carew, who was causing us all manner of problems, and Sanchez as well. But we hold on to the 78th minute. And, you know, that's key, isn't it? Because Celtic tend to have a tendency, if we lose an early goal, we could lose two or three, and to hold on to the 78th minute, if nothing else, just gives us that little bit of, you know, backbone, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I do think that we would have taken a lot of belief from the first leg in terms of what we then did in the second leg. Not as much as that we matched them in terms of football and ability, but that we were able to contain such a good side. And I think you're right. I think so many of the really poor away European performances from us in that era were kind of punctured with early... It was either late heartbreak, wasn't it? Like, or it was early disaster. You know, the Shakhtar away and, you know, things like that, you know.
Porto?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we either capitulated or there was kind of late heartbreak, if you will. But I think in knockout football like that, it's different in terms of the Champions League group stages. If you, the fact that we kind of held them to that long and then managed to kind of cement that it was only a 1-0 kind of defeat, I think would have gave us a bit of belief. You can almost hear Martin O'Neill in the pre-match for the home leg in terms of what we'd done in that game. He used to take things like that and turn it around, and then you've heard reports of players saying that the hairs in the back of their neck would be standing up when he spoke. He would have just drawn from the resistance, if you will, that we had against them for most of that game, and then laid it out flat for them, which I know we're going to talk about the game now, but you could just almost see that then unfold in the first part of the home leg. But no, I think you're right. I think that would have been really important in building belief.
So yeah, building belief, I think, is the kind of key. After the game, Martin O'Neill, his comments are, "I was very pleased with the performance given the players we were missing and the players we had to bring in." I mean, that's true. Essentially, he's missing four first-team players from starting 11. So, you know, to get a 1-0 defeat against the team that had been, you know, two European Cup finals in a row is what a performance. With no disrespect to guys like Stephen Craney, very inexperienced. And you know, Maravchik, as we've mentioned, his legs were kind of going at that point. So to have him play, have him start in that sort of position is, you know, tough. But again, fantastic stuff. We showed a lot of desire. Valencia have shown that they are a very good side. But in 2 weeks' time, we are going to give everything we have to try to get through. It was almost like it's half time in the tie. You've done your bit. Now it's time for us to do our bit. And Martin O'Neill was always really great at presenting that. Like, that's done. Now it's their turn. And it was almost, I know this is going to sound completely off kind of topic, it's almost like a weird sort of storytelling. You always sort of try to tell stories in between kind of ties and just before games. And as Chris said about, you know, he really captured the imagination of not only the players, but of us. And I think that's what led to the buzz in the stadium. Alan, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, you need to bear in mind that what Martin O'Neill's strengths were was, I think, player psychology was, you know, that was his... You know, I was about to use the expression that was his jam, but I don't really think that fits at all in the circumstances. But that's what Martin O'Neill, you know, that's what he was known for. You know, you've heard the way players will talk about how he communicated with players. it wasn't that put your arm around players and be their best mate. It was very, very distant. And you've got to think about the lineage of who he came through under, playing under Brian Clough. You know, it was the manager was seen as, you know, someone that actually maybe wasn't approachable. It wasn't somebody you would go to and say, here's how I'm feeling, here's how I'm, you know, here's what I'm looking for. It was very much an employer-employee relationship, you know. There was exceptions to that, of course, and when you had done your job, it was very different. But he would ask and expect you to do exactly what was needed. And I think, you know, we'll come on and talk about the home game, but there's a lot that I think you can add into that. But I think it's one of the things that's a wee bit lost now. You know, Samani mentioned that about, you know, how he would address players pre-match, half-time. And I think it was a number of players have said that his team talk at Anfield is the best I've ever heard, and just said it's simply incredible. I think it's a wee bit something now that I don't think it's given the same credence now in terms of giving a proper team talk, but it's a massive thing. Putting players out in the right frame of mind and make sure they're fired up in the right way with the right instructions. If you have players that are willing to do exactly what you need, I think it's underrated a little bit sometimes that giving the players just that right amount of fire in their belly before a game like this, it's massive. Because, and when you watch the game, we're maybe in a privileged position here because we've all sat and watched this home leg back. But when you go and watch that, you can then imagine when you watch the first 20, 25 minutes, what the players have been told and how good it was, because there's players doing things in that park that our memories of them are formed over 3-4 years of their abilities. But watching this 20-25 minutes, you're thinking, you know, they've had a nandrolone injection or something pretty much, because it's just that good. That much energy, there's that much going into it that you think there's no way they can sustain this for 90 minutes.
Barry?
I was just going to say, just to give a sort of overview of how much this team had to give, was the very next game after Valencia, we played Rangers at home and we turned them over. Now, the sort of effort they would have taken, particularly when four of your first team players aren't playing, up against it with sort of the Sutton thing that I mentioned as well, and to come back and beat Rangers, right sort of sandwiched in between, give or take a couple of games, these two games, just shows you the magnitude that this team could go to the well over and over again. And Alan mentioned about the sort of lack of training. There probably wouldn't have been much time to train at all, even before that Rangers game. You come back off a flight, turned in a really good performance against one of the best sides in Europe, and then you come back and beat Rangers. So it just shows you that there was so much sort of belief and ability in this squad, and just sort of romanticising now how good it was, because it was unbelievable, and you feel sort of giddy thinking about it.
We play Valencia in the Mestalla in Spain. It's a 1-0 defeat, first leg. Barry's right. That was on the Thursday. On the Sunday, we played Rangers at Celtic Park. We beat them 2-1, Valharen and Larsson. Then, on the 1st of December, so we put the actual game that we're going to talk about is the Valencia home tie. That's on the 6th. On the 1st of December, we play Hibs. We beat Hibs 3-0. I'm just going to give you a read over the first kind of comments from the match report. Celtic 3, Hibs 0. Celtic made it 12 league wins in a row with a comfortable triumph over Hibs at Parkhead. John Hartson capped a great performance with 2 goals and set up Neil Lennon's strike. Neil Lennon also scored. The champions moved 13 points clear at the top of the SPL. This was in December. This was against Dick Advocaat and his, you know, perceived he's going to come in and he's just going to dominate Scottish football for the next, you know, 20 years. That's what we were told by the Scottish press and the Scottish media. The Dick Advocaat, you kind of get close to him. He's something that you've never seen before. And, you know, in that first season, it looked fairly like that. But Martin O'Neill absolutely costs him his job, because Alex McLeish is the Hibs manager at this point, and he's made him, the Advocaat steps aside, made a right dick of him, absolutely no question about it. His name's Dick Advocaat, and I said Dick. Okay, fine, whatever, that's great. looking at the...
We'll be hearing that, yes, I agree, girl, that's a very funny joke again.
Yes, you are doing so good. Celtic versus Valencia, Chris Armani, thoughts on going to the game? Tell me, how good was the atmosphere for this game? Tell me about you going to the game.
People talk about this being the greatest atmosphere that they've experienced at Celtic Park. I wouldn't disagree, although, you know, you can throw in other games that you've been at where the atmosphere's been good. It's the loudest I've heard Celtic Park. That for me, is the one thing that you can't escape from. You know, it's fun to argue, you know, pub arguments about the best atmosphere you've been to. This is definitely in the running. But, you know, at that age, I would have been 18. I remember going to the game and just... I couldn't believe, I hadn't heard that level of noise. No matter, you know, any Rangers games I'd been to, any other European games I'd been to, I had never been in the stadium. I didn't realise it was capable of kind of holding that noise. People talk about cadets debut 5-0. Domestic games are different from European games, that goes without saying, but people talk about him scoring and, you know, it kicked five live off the air. I mean, this could have kicked BBC One off the air, the noise in that stadium that day. It might be the best atmosphere. I mean, you know, I don't really mind too much about that as an argument, but that's the one thing that hit me. The wall of noise is something that I hadn't heard before or since. And going up to the game, I think we've talked about this in other podcasts as well. Sometimes you walk up to the game and it hits you when you get in the ground. There seemed to be something outside the ground for me as well. If I can remember going up, it just felt... I don't know. It might have been... It's difficult to kind of... You've touched on the fact we were on a 12-game run in the league and stuff. You forget about some of this context when you're thinking back. So maybe it was just because confidence was riding so high or whatever. But I do remember going up and you could feel the kind of electricity outside. And I've never, ever... It was almost like... when you get off a plane in a hot country and it just smacks you in the face, the volume was like that for me that day.
Barry, thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, I was trying to think what would have made it feel like that and what made the noise so loud. And as I kind of said that I think it was the best atmosphere. I think it was because it was almost like being given a second chance because we'd got finished third in the group. And this was a sort of reward for doing that in the Champions League. And as Samari said right at the top, we were used to being whipping boys in Europe and going straight out. So to have enjoyed a successful, at least successful home campaign in our first ever Champions League group, this was like a second chance and we just had to go for it. And I think based on the back of the performance, 5-6 weeks earlier against Juventus, there was just an appetite for another big team coming to Celtic Park with the ties still very much alive after the first leg. And it was just, it's hard to describe because it's one game that, when I was looking back on this, it's one game that I can visualise really well how I was feeling at that time. And just, as we come on to talk about, the game was so up and down, the emotions, it had everything. And the fans majorly played their part that night. And it was just a joy to behold.
Barry, I'm sorry, Alan, you want to come in?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things, you know, somebody trying to get to the root of what would drive the atmosphere. And I think knockout football. I think it's something, you know, especially a second leg. You know, Champions League group stage, you know, I remember probably one of the better atmospheres I've ever experienced was the home game against Man City. Just incredible, the pace of it. But when there's six games, there's margin for error. And I think the thing is, in this game, you've lost 1-0 away. You know, you've kind of come through that, if you like. You know, everybody walking up, you know, to the stadium that night would know exactly what they were in for. We know that how Celtic were going to have to approach it. You knew what was going. You were going to have to score. And I think Barry's used the expression before, you know, at Celtic Park, sometimes in these nights, the fans almost, you know, you're willing the ball into the net as if you have some sort of control over that. And I feel like that was the, you know, the dynamics of the game certainly didn't hurt that because the pace at which the players approached it, that would help. But pre-match, everybody going would know what's required. You either are going to be leaving the stadium at the end of the night, having gone through or being out. And that drives an atmosphere. I think, you know, I love knockout football. It's a bit rarer now. You know, you've got group stages in Europa League, but that's why I love the old UEFA Cup, because it was knockout football. You know, it adds a tension and a pressure to it that Scottish Cup and League Cup's different, because we know we should win those games. And I know that sounds horrible, but that's the reality of it. Whereas this was a proper knockout tie. And I think this, O'Neill thrived under that. You know, O'Neill teams thrived under that pressure. He knew how to get enough out of players. So I think that's probably what was behind what was simply one of the most incredible atmospheres. You know, I was there with my brother. I would have been 12 at the time, and it just absolutely unbelievable. You know, the best atmosphere up until that time, surely. Even 6-2, you know, which was incredible. The atmosphere, the noise in this night is just, you know, there's a difference, as Samani rightly pointed out, between atmosphere and volume. But the volume in this night was deafening, absolutely deafening.
I remember thinking, I remember seeing my sister. So I met my sister after work, went to Kelly's on the south side, few pints in the supporters bus. And I remember walking up towards Celtic Park. And I remember saying to her that they could only beat us 1-0. They could, like, totally, because we were at the Beanback and we get scudded. But my walking up to that game, seeing the lights and being like, they could only beat us 1-0. Now we're going to show them what home football is about, kind of thing. And it was just like, you know, you talked about the start about, you know, we're probably hit out with a couple of, you know, footballing cliches. I'm sure Martin O'Neill basically said, just leave it all out there. Like, just give them everything. Give everything you can, because as you say, the margin for error is very, very slim. And anyway, let me talk you through the Celtic teams. Martin O'Neill had a big decision to make, because Chris Sutton was available again, and, you know, Hartson had scored two against Hibs. What was your kind of take on Hartson at that point, Chris? You know, when he comes in, he scores goals, but he's not playing every week. He's in and out. What's your thoughts?
My issue with Hartson is that at times he was accommodated, and it broke up one of the best strike partnerships in Europe. I was always very dismissive of playing Sutton in midfield. Sutton would do a job for you in midfield. Sutton could play centre half. But see, at times where they kind of shoehorned Hartson in because of, you know, his goal scoring abilities and because of what he cost and his profile. You know, for me, sometimes that was to the detriment of the best strike partnership I've ever seen at Celtic. So I always had, I mean, his goal scoring record for us was phenomenal. Even after O'Neill, you know, we touched on that when we spoke about some of the Strachan seasons. His goal scoring record was ridiculous. He scored some important goals for us, big goals for us. But I was my view of him is unfair, because for me, Sutton and Larson was a ridiculous front pairing. And I maybe didn't appreciate him as much. So if Sutton was going to be in the team over Hartson at that time, then I would have been all for that.
Celtic go back to the back three. Douglas is in goals. We've got Baldy, Mialbi and Valharen. Then you've got that kind of that three of Petrov, Lambert and Lennon. Mravchik on one side, Petta on the other. I totally forgot Petta played in this game.
I think it was played on the right.
Yeah, Petrov was on the right, and I think that's what kind of was alluding to earlier in terms of, you know, because Momo Sylla was on the bench for this,
yeah. But
it was just a case of, I trust Pet Stan to do a job in there, and then asking Lubo to do the 10, which, you know, I don't think he did. I think those two performers in the team that didn't really pan out in that night, and I think Lubo was certainly one of them, which is rare, but the rest, you know, everybody else left out in the pitch. But putting Petrov at right, I think highlighted that Martin O'Neill would, because that's not a natural position for him. I know he'd played right back a few times, but it wasn't his position, it wasn't his role, and especially at that level, you can maybe do it in domestic league games, but asking a guy to do a job like that against a team like that, I think it just highlighted that he wanted energy, but he wanted someone that was going to impact the game further up the park. It was about having somebody that had the ability to come inside with the ball, and when you need to score, quite simply, without being disrespectful to Momo Sylla, who scored a phenomenal European goal for us in a qualifier, he's not at that level. And it's just, it might be his natural position, But if you really want to go through, you've got to pick the players that can impact these games. And Stelian Petrov is one of those players. Momo Sylla quite simply wasn't. And that was, I think that was highlights Martin O'Neill's approach to the game and philosophy of the game. You know, it's about your talent. It's not really about your position, and it's about what you can do. And Stan Petrov can quite simply do more than, you know, Momo Sylla could in that night.
Yeah. Barry, we had that. We're back to the back three, 3-5-2. You've got Larson and Sutton. You've got, as Chris says, probably the best partnership from a striking point of view we've ever seen. Baldy, Mielby, Valharin, that is really, really solid. That's three players who know exactly when and how to play that position, even at this level. And that midfield kind of five. You're looking at that, I mean, the fact that we've changed formation again, that is kind of, you know, you're better playing that three, though, than the four.
Yeah, I think so. Especially when we want to take the game to them. And it's funny, I was thinking about this when Petta starts, because it was weird that season that Petta and Thompson would kind of swap for a fair bit, and sometimes they would both play. You would have Thompson the sort of left of the three with Petta outside them. But I think the reason why Petta maybe played this is because, as Alan said, on the right-hand side, you're missing a gap because of the injury, and Petrov's playing out of a natural position, so you need genuine width there. So I think that's why Petta would have started this. But that back three, that's peak Martin O'Neill. I think that's, you think of Martin O'Neill's team, it's those three. You think of the midfield, I know Petrov's on the right, but you would have Lambert, Petrov, and Lennon in there. So it's, and Larson sitting up front. Just to go back to the Hartson thing, it's, I liked Hartson as a player, and it's, as Manny said, it's hard to discredit him with the amount of goals he scored, but I can't help but think that $6 million could have been used to sort of elsewhere in the team. Maybe you could have used that money to get Lobo's replacement. But that's been incredibly harsh with what Hartson had done for us.
Aye. Just get that goal against Liverpool at Anfield to fuck, Barry. That's basically what you're saying. Aye, good for you.
Well, I said about the Celtic fans later on.
To be fair, we're both blocked by him on Twitter, but that's for very different reasons.
And we did win that game comfortably as well, so we could have done without that goal, let's be honest.
Good point. Valencia, I mean, Canizares was in goals. Ayala, Ariello, Pellegrini, Carboni was a great player as well. Like, there are just so many really consistently high performers in this team. Djukic was great. Torres, Vicente. I don't really remember De Los Santos that much.
Oh, he was the man in the match for Valencia in this night. He was, oh, what a player. I don't know much of him beyond that, but he was a standout player this day, in this game.
Yeah, I just don't really remember much about him like before or after that. But Pablo Aimar is fantastic in this game as well, and John Carew, who always caused us trouble. Let's talk about the game, Chris. Celtic start out the blocks, like, you know, like a boxer wanting to end a bout really quickly. What was your kind of take on it?
Just the pace, and the pace matched the atmosphere, if you will. One of the other games that kind of struck me that we came out off the back of an atmosphere and really quick was the home leg when we were talking about Liverpool and the UEFA Cup run in 2003. That the great thing about that is if you've got the crowd and everything behind you, you can really catch the opposition unawares. In your head, the rational part of you is in the background speaking very quietly, saying, we can't keep this up. But the passionate part of the football supporter just thinks you just get absolutely swept up in the whole thing. And I think Alan touched on it in terms of the performance, though. It wasn't just the pace and the frenetic nature of it. They were playing phenomenal football. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but we're sitting here on the 13th of March, 2021. Neil Lennon's not the most popular man in terms of us. Neil Lennon was frightening in this game. Absolutely frightening. He is a guy who we are very quick to dismiss in terms of what he'd done for us as a football player. And you know, I feel dirty talking about him in such glowing terms after what's just happened. But Neil Lennon looked every inch the European midfielder in this game. He was unbelievable. That first 20-25 minutes, we looked like There's a few games, you know, you've talked about it and we mentioned earlier on that we needed to be at a certain level to compete with these teams, you know. There's times where around this era where we look like a comfortable European side. We look like a really top-class European side. Lyon at home was one of the other ones, I thought. First 20-25 minutes, we just looked like we could go toe-to-toe with absolutely anybody in Europe. And for me, I just kind of get swept up in that. And it's a rush. It was a rush to watch it. I mean, I watched back most of the game. I couldn't watch it all back, but I certainly watched the first half, and it was a joy to watch. And it's kind of slightly sad thinking back to where we were at the time, you know, and what we had, and maybe we should maybe appreciate it a bit more.
Yeah, we come out of the blocks, Alan. Just straight off the back, it's just pressure. Just right from the very kickoff, we pressure Valencia and just hold them back for about 25 minutes. Talk us through it.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously there'll be the stats and tactical breakdown, which I'll go into that in more detail. But Valencia can't put 3-4 passes together. This is a team that, you know, smothered you in their own stadium 2 weeks before. And then, you know, as Samani says, it's almost like it can be a double-edged sword having an atmosphere like that at Celtic Park, and we very much understand that. I think people that have been to Celtic Park know what that's like, because the atmosphere can be up here. If it doesn't start the way you want it to, that can either drop very quickly, you know, like busting a balloon, or it can just dissipate away, and that then gives the energy back to, you know, the opposition. We've seen that happen, you know, PSG, incredible atmosphere come out of the stadium quicker than you can believe. But on this, you know, watching it back, it was a joy to watch, to be honest. You know, I said right at the top, it was a proper game of football. It was, it had everything. As soon as Celtic lost possession, the fervour with which they went and won it back was just incredible. Valencia could not put 3, 4, 5 passes together. They have two spells in the game, one in each half, where they do, and you can see their quality. You know, they create some opportunities in this game, which I think people sometimes forget, because they do have real, real quality. But that battle in the middle of the park, and I think Samani's absolutely right to point out, Neil Lennon and Paul Lambert controlled this game. It's not just the winning back of the ball, you know, because that's what we associate with these guys. Their passing was phenomenal. See some of the passing, you know, from direct passing from Neil Lennon into Sutton, Larson, and then getting it back. It's not just a case of Neil Lennon protecting. They don't do that job in this night because they don't need to. We dominate the game. We don't create a lot in that first 20, 25 minutes. You know, there's kind of half chances. You know, Chris Sutton's getting an opportunity. But it's the way we dominate possession. We just keep the ball. We keep probing. But it's not just passing side to side. It's not that passive possession. We're probing at all times. And to be honest, it was like watching a wee bit of a different sport. It really felt like it. I thought the performances were incredible. The two players I'd mentioned that I don't think get into the game, I think you can see that quite early. We don't have any, Barry mentioned, natural width. Bobby Petta has a really, really poor game. We don't have any width in the right-hand side. So it all has to come in the middle of the park. When you've got Sutton and Larson, you can do that. You know, you've got two up front. We don't really go down wide a lot because we don't have anything. We've not got talent going forward there. It's all in the between the kind of width of the penalty box. That's where it all happens. And it's brilliant to watch. I can't recommend enough if people are listening to it. Obviously, we'll talk about it. But the best thing you can go and do is just watch this game. It's a fantastic game of football. It really is. And it's great to see. You know, Paul Lambert, it's almost not like the player I remember. You know, it's yeah. I think when time goes past, you associate him with sitting protecting in the same way as Neil Lennon, but it's not. It's very different. It's great to watch, and I would recommend it highly, but some of the passing is fantastic. I mean, we'll get to the more detail of the game, but I struggle to think of a better start. You know, 6-2 game, we managed to score 3 in the first 11 minutes, but we didn't play like this. This is, you're playing against a top-level European team, and they can't get a sniff of the ball. It's fantastic.
Barry, I remember at the time, and obviously watching back as well, Valencia looked rattled. It's almost as if they weren't expecting this level of intensity. As we mentioned, you know, Chris is saying that it's in the back of your head, we can't keep this up. There's no question I would have been sitting there like, I don't give a fuck if I can't keep it up. Keep going. And that's kind of what it felt like at the time. It's hard to get to kind of get that atmosphere of keep going, let's go, come on, let's go. But that's kind of what it was at that time.
Yeah, and it's funny, Sarmani sort of linked it back to how we're all feeling just now, but remember earlier this season when we went to the San Siro and Lennon said we were breathtaking? This was proper breathtaking this night. It was bravery on the ball, like you couldn't believe. Like, how many times do we go to Celtic Park now and watch a Champions League game and we can't believe how quick and how sort of carefree defenders look and midfielders look with zipping the ball into strikers? That's what we did. It was, I'd actually forgotten how good we were until I went back and watched it. I think the word frenetic was spot on from Sarmani. It was just the crowd and the team pulling together as one, and it was quite a force. We threw everything at them. The odd time when the ball went out for a throw-in, you could see that the Valencia players were knackered. They were just looked completely in shell-shocked of how good that we were playing against them. And Alan mentioned the midfield battle. I think one of the sort of key things we might come on to talk about was see the battle between Bobo and John Carew. It was like two heavyweight boxers. Like, there's one point in the second half where Bobo crunches him and Carew just gets up, and it was just like mutual respect, and it was great to see. And it is honestly, as Alan said, it is honestly one of the best games of football you can watch. Celtic look every part of the modern football team. And I know it's hard to say that now because we don't look it, but we were playing well beyond our years. You put that in a football game now and people would be raving about it, I think.
Yeah.
Timeless.
Yeah, absolutely, Barry. Spot on. Chris Amani.
Just very quickly on John Carew. John Carew's reputation is moulded by his latter years in England, where I don't think he was the same football player. But John Carew was a great, he was a handful, you know. I mean, he's not a great technical football player, you know, in that sense of it. But John Carew could handle himself against any man other than the defender. You know, he was, the very least you were getting if you're a centre-half up against John Carew was a difficult night. And in terms of Baldy, we think of Baldy in terms of his physique and, you know, the strength that he brought to the game. That's exactly what it is. When you said heavyweight boxers, it was just toe-to-toe. And, you know, a lot of that side of the game, you know, it's almost like British, if you will, you know, the physical side of the game. But that was a joy to watch two guys just going at it. And, it you know, that side of the game sometimes is kind of put to the side because, you know, we talk about the technical beauty of it and all that sort of stuff. But that was a great physical battle in the evening.
I should point out, that's a good point about John Carew. At this point in John Carew's career, he was still relatively young and he was fast. He was really, really, really fast. He had a great ton of pace on him, Alan.
And I think as alongside that, you know, in the first half, he struggles, you know, because we're on top. But you can see that at all times he has a threat. But he nearly scores a spectacular, it's not quite an overhead kick, you know, but it's, you give him what, he manages to free himself from Baldy and pin himself onto Mialbi, and you can see that right away, the joy that he gets from that, and he gets a, it's just maybe a couple inches over the bar, but it's a frenetic game, as you guys have said, and there is that power, aggression, pace, but it's got real, real quality. I think Aymar manages to wriggle himself free in the box and he picks out the pass to Carew, and they really don't have a lot of time in this game, but see, when you do allow them to get that 3-4 passes and they get high up the park, it's one of those ones that's, I think people that have obviously been to Celtic Park in nights like this will know, obviously, you know, when other teams score, but see, when another team gets a chance, there's almost that collective
gasp.
Exactly, gasp around the stadium, and it's just like a warning that as much as this is good and this is a quality opposition, and if they get one chance, then if they take it, then that's it. And I think that again feeds back into this idea of the atmosphere, because they struggle to get into the game, but they do create when they do, and they manage to get a couple of chances, and it is brilliant. It's a proper European tie, and it all is driven from that right to earn, you know, your place in the battle, because that's how it starts. And to be fair to Valencia, they do manage to kind of set themselves in it after, because they are reeling after that 20-25 minutes. But you can see their quality because they manage to, kind of like we did, you know, you look at it from their perspective, they hang in there. They don't give away anything cheap. You know, I think Canizares rushes out in the first couple of minutes. But beyond that, you don't see them making rash decisions, any stupid decisions. They manage to hang in there in the same way that we do. And then that kind of feeds into what is then, you know, the second half's incredible. And the last 15, 20 minutes of the first half, I think, is when, for all our dominance, it's not until that later part of the first half that we actually start to create. And then when we do, they start to come kind of thick and fast almost.
Fisker's the referee. He's Danish. He's a good referee. He's a strong referee. Doesn't give anything away silly. Like we've seen plenty of referees like that at Celtic Park. But what I thought was quite interesting was the first time I kind of heard the kind of phrase like high line was years after this. Oh, this manager really attacking football plays a really really high line, and I remember when those first 25 minutes. Sitting with my sister and saying, look how high up our defenders are. Like, our defenders were at, like, just at almost at the halfway line because we had them pinned back. What then happens is they start to get a little bit of control and we become a little bit further back and a little bit further back. We're not deep because the game kind of, it's like, you know, seven gold where it kind of balances out a little bit. What did you think when, you know, Chris, that, when they're 25 minutes up of real pressure and real dominance, Valencia start to come into it a little bit more. How, you know, at the time and since you've been watching it, rewatching it, gut instinct, what's it tell you at that point?
I think when it settled down in many ways, we're talking about the first 25 minutes, and Alan rightly points out that there was quality in there in terms of our possession and our passing. But I think what that proved, after that settles down, it's not just bluster, you know. There was some more substance to it. They'd managed to get a foothold in the game more so than they had in the early part of it. But then it became, I think later in the half, it calmed down and it showed you that we weren't just kind of riding on the crest of a wave. There was real quality in there as well. And we'd came back, but it was more of a contest. And I think Alan points out that most of our chances do come in the latter parts of it. Obviously, we'll come on to talk about the goal. We'll talk about Lubel's chance at the end of the first half as well. But I think when it settled down, I think that's a credit. It wasn't as if we were just battered. They regrouped. And then it was a case of it's going to be one-way traffic from Valencia. We kept a foothold in the game at a slower pace because the pace would have to drop. But we were probably allowed that drop in paces allowed us to think a wee bit more, and maybe there was a bit more of a spark after that. I don't think it's easy to watch back, because when you watch back games, you know what the score is and you know what's going to happen. I don't think at the time, thinking back to the game, that I thought when the pace dropped, we're in trouble here. It almost kind of broke into a better game of football, if you will, in terms of a contest. And it just seemed, that's the way it seemed to develop at the time. But I think the point made there, though, is we almost seemed to, our thought process seemed to slow down a wee bit more, and we seemed to get a wee bit more clinical towards the end of the first half, I would say.
A bit like a boxing match, Samani, where the first round and stuff, really fast-paced and kind of aggressive, and then both fighters kind of fall into the match a little bit. Is that a fair assessment?
It can go both ways, can't it? I mean, you can feel each other out and nothing much happens, and then you start to kind of move in and change your performance. But it's certainly like that, where there was that frenetic first burst, and then it kind of settles down and you understand what each opponent's capable of. That certainly seemed to be it. It was almost like we were going for that, if you're wanting the comparison to boxing, the early knockout. But then we realised that our opponent's far more durable than that, and we need to kind of box more cleverly. And I suppose that analogy does kind of bear fruit in this example.
Barry?
I think that's why the atmosphere maintained its quality, because as Samani says, we tried to get that early goal and it didn't happen, and we've seen it before in games where that can knock the crowd and knock the team. But we became more methodical in our approach. We showed that we weren't just bluster, as Samani said. We could think our way through it. The quality of passing still maintained, but it wasn't just that 100 miles an hour stuff. And I think that sort of transpired to the crowd. The crowd could see that, like, we've tried one way, but we're still going at it. Maybe not at the same intensity, but we were still in with a shout and still playing at our absolute peak. And I think that's what I'm saying about the crowd and the team working as one. And that continued throughout the match, I think.
For me personally, I'd like your thoughts on this, Alan, as well. This, to me, this game shows Chris Sutton's intelligence. The positions he takes up, how he uses the ball, and how he brings people into the ball. It's not, Sutton has never been about, you know, just scoring goals. He's not that type of striker. His intelligence really stands out. Would you agree with that, Alan?
Yeah, I think Chris Sutton, you can almost, within the first 30, 35 minutes, is his place in the team. You know, obviously you mentioned John Hartson scoring the goals before, and John Hartson's a quality striker. But Chris Sutton's role in this game isn't really in the box, actually, a lot of the time. It's dropping off, taking a centre-half with him, and just allowing you to kind of set up camp in the Valencia half by providing that, you know, it's that classic foil. Just dropping off, playing a 1-2, taking a defender in, and then things happen in behind him. He can get involved again later, but his performance in this first half is majestic. It really is. I mean, quite simply, everything that you throw at him sticks. You know, me and I think Aaron Connolly have talked a lot and laugh a lot about the way that this modern Celtic team fire the ball into strikers and it doesn't stick. Watching this performance and the way some of the passes are played into him, some of them are fed into him beautifully. Some of them are neck, chest height, and he just uses his frame to prevent the defender from getting in at it. And then it's just a case of his control of the ball is fantastic. I mean, it's hard to think of a comparative striker to him in terms of that, somebody that could just bring you 30, 40 yards higher up the park by feeding balls into him in any way, shape or form. He's brilliant in this game. He really is. And he was always a clever striker. You know, when the way he attacked the ball, for instance, phenomenal. We've seen that, I think, very early in, against Ajax in Europe, how he could do that. But that's raw power, whereas this is, as you see, that intelligence to drop in, know where the ball is going to come in. And then a play between him, Neil Lennon, Paul Lambert, and, you know, not so much in this game, but Lubo Moravcek, at times was just spectacular. Yeah. And it all comes from the ability that Sutton has to receive the ball under pressure in dangerous areas and then just pop it off again. And then everything then happens off him. And without him, John Hartson was a great striker and a great finisher. He wasn't quite that intelligent. He could hold the ball in, but I don't think he had the same ability as Sutton to give it back in the same way so that things could happen behind him. You know, he was a great, strong physical presence, but he didn't have the ability to pop the ball off in the same way as Chris Sutton did.
Chris Armani, do you think that teams like Valencia and even Juventus and, you know, maybe this would change, but do you think they underestimated Sutton's footballing brain and footballing ability? Because I think a lot of maybe people saw him as like a sort of old school British striker, hold the ball up, get on the end of crosses, but he was far more than that. Do you think he was underestimated?
I don't know. I mean, more broadly, his reputation would have been damaged by his spell at Chelsea, but that's just the kind of nature of the Premier League, you know. I mean, and I think we've seen subsequently, Chelsea is the football club strikers go to die. You know, Shevchenko, Torres, well, this season, your man Werner as well. It's an odd club when it comes to strikers who have unbelievable quality at other football clubs. So I don't think they would have. I think, you know, in terms of what he'd done for us and, you know, the previous, they would have had an appreciation of his quality. Maybe not an appreciation of just how good he was, but the fact of the matter is, it wasn't like they only had to cope with Chris Sutton. They had to cope with a player who's even greater than him, which kind of says it all about that in terms of a partnership. But I think Alan's spot on there. I mean, in terms of what Chris Sutton can do in bringing other team players in, I mean, remember the game where he came on against Barcelona and then ended, you know, he came on off the bench. Very, a striker like Sutton, it's very rare for somebody to come on and completely galvanise a side in that manner. And that's what he can do. You know, his goal scoring record doesn't compare to Hartson's. But in terms of who else he brought in games, I just think he was a level above. And I think that Alan's talking about him coming short for passes from Lennon and Lambert and stuff like that. You know, we'll talk about the chance, you know, see if Petrov would maybe be in the middle in terms of breaking the line after that. I think we might get more success because we've seen a wee bit of that with Moravcek. But he didn't have the legs that he once did or whatever. See, you're just thinking, see if we had something outright and you'd Petrov, he might have got a lot more joy coming in because of that and Sutton popping it off. But c'est la vie, that's just the way that we had to line up due to factors in the day.
Huh?
It's not going to be a popular But Lubo was stinking in this game. Like, this has got to be, you know, it wasn't until I watched it back, but I didn't really have a great recollection of him in this game. And it's easy to see why. I mean, even his set-piece delivery is really, really poor in the game, and we get quite a lot of set-pieces in the game because Valencia are giving a lot of fouls away, and you know, particularly in that first half. And he does... It's a difficult one because the chance that Lubo gets, he creates for himself off his own back.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a lovely... It's a double nutmeg. I think Henrik does it, gets fouled, and then Lubo does the same, and it's, you know, it's a lovely bit of skill. But it's just very unlike him to be in that position and, you know, right or left foot, and he just... he's no control over the strike, and I think he gets hooked quite early in the first half, and you can see why. You know, you talked about maybe having Petrov in behind with that late run that he, you know, it was his trademark, really. He was incredible at it, but it does, you've lost that in there. You know, I think Barry mentioned about Alan Thompson being in there as well. You can see why you would pick Lubo, quite simply because we know and knew what he was capable of. But in this game, he is really, really poor. He struggles to get into it. It's almost as if the game is just quite simply too quick for him, and I don't want to disparage Lobo because I absolutely loved him, but the pace of this game is frightening, as we've said, and he struggles to make any imprint on it off the back of that. And it's something, to be honest, that I've never really thought about. You know, it's the first time I've rewatched a game since, you know, being there on the night. And it is clear that he doesn't get himself in this game, and it's easy to see why he does get hooked.
Barry?
I was just going to say, I think the main reason why O'Neill would have gone with him is because of the Juventus game the couple of months before. And I know that, I think I've spoken about this before, but Lubo wasn't really played in many of the Champions League games that year, but there was a big clambering for him to play in that game to give us something extra. And he performed, so you can see why, but I think Samani said right at the start, he would have been here, he'd have been 36 maybe?
Yeah, 35, 36, yeah.
And it was a different type of game. I think because of the pace of it, as Alan touched on there, it maybe was just too much for him. But that chance, brilliant skill. And then you can see, I think, the reaction from Martin O'Neill when Lubo hits over the bar tells you, because you know how good Lubo is. And normally you'd have put your house on him scoring there, either foot. But I think because he was having such a poor game, he tries to blast it as hard as he can. And that's what is his downfall.
Yeah.
I think that this chance comes at nothing each as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because I watched the game, the full highlights, or the full game stories on YouTube, but then I watched quite a few other, like, I think they've got like Sports Scene highlights, and then there's some fan footage of the penalty shootout. And on Sports Scene, they talk about Lubo Mravčić has a great chance to make it 2-0 to Celtic. And I remember just thinking, like, surely you've watched the whole game. Surely the person that's... But they talk about it and saying, well, it's a great chance. It could have been 2-0 before half-time if Lubo Mravčić had taken this chance. And you're thinking, all the people involved in that, it's good to see that the standards in Scottish broadcast media and journalism have been consistently poor. You know, one of the biggest games that Celtic have ever taken part in Europe against a great European team. And we are lamenting Lubo for, you know, not putting us 2-0 up when, you know, it scores not an each.
You know who it was? It was Gordon Smith, so I think enough said.
Enough said. I've got written down here...
I disagree. I don't think enough has been said.
that's the last I'll say on it.
I've got written down here that the first half, Larsson is a big chance. Not big chance, but half chances, as you both sort of said. Larsson has a chance. Sutton has an opportunity. Petrov has an opportunity. Lubo makes the 44th minute. It's, as we say, you know, Lubo nutmegs the onrushing defender. And it is, he makes his own space, and there is a lot of space as well. Canizares is a magnificent goalkeeper. He's very tall. He's very intimidating in terms of, you know, he's in the goals, and Lubo just blasts it over. As you see, Martin O'Neill looks frustrated. You're thinking at that point, Chris, that, okay, we're at half-time. As we mentioned, John Carew has an opportunity on overhead to kick. There's another opportunity that I think Vicente has. It's kind of, you know, back and forth in terms of that. But we get to this point where it's the 44th minute. Lubo puts over and you think, well, half-time 0-0. At least we've not conceded. But then something happens. What happens?
Score, Gil.
Oh, talk us through it.
No, I think you're right. I mean, Lubo's chance was a big one for him, and I think Alan's kind of right to point out that this really was a poor performance from him. And I mean, he did make it, but your memories of Lubo are being cool under pressure in that manner. 3-0 game, 3-0 game away to Rangers the season before, just tucking it in sort of thing. And I think probably at the time you're thinking, yeah, you're happy just to get in here 0-0. Maybe a wee bit disappointed not to have taken that chance. But then he scored when we score. Scoring just before half-time is always good. Send you in on a high, send you in. Keeps that kind of frenetic pace going. And what a finish. What a finish from Henrik Larsson. I mean, we can probably come and break the goal down a bit more, but you just... The sheer quality in that finish is absolutely unreal. The way he curls it, the way it dips just past Canizares and goes in the far corner. You're just... That's just a classic Larsson goal. And see, when you watch back that, you just can't help but smile and be sad at the same time, because will we see his likes again? Probably not.
Alan?
You know, when you watch maybe Champions League games, I don't know if anybody watched the games during the week, and when... just before a goal scored, they've got the, I think it's IBM or I don't know, whoever it is that does it, where they freeze the kind of scene,
yeah,
and then they do the 360 pivot so that you can see it from all different angles. I would say this is the goal. If I had the option of doing that for any Celtic goal in history, this is the one I would do it for, because the technique, as Samani says, the body shape of Henrik is odd. Like, his technique is quite unusual because he almost leans quite far back, and he's, you know, everybody, you know, he was very gestury, Henrik, in terms of his arms were never, you know, they were never tight by his side, but his arms were always out, exactly what you're doing.
Like Pinocchio. You
know. Yes, like, exactly like Pinocchio, that's what I was thinking. but this goal is perfect for it, because the angle of, obviously, the strike's great. I was in the main stand on the right-hand side, so we had a great view of this in terms of it's almost like he was shaping up to look at the main stand, and he then bends it in. It is incredible, and I would love it. You know, obviously technology's moved on a lot, but having that footage of seeing him in that moment and freezing it, because it is a spectacular goal. I think it's actually an underrated goal. I don't think it's one that, you know, the bend that he gets in the ball to put it past a world-class keeper like that is just, well, it's brilliant. I'll be honest, apart from, I remember him shaping up to shoot, I don't remember the celebrations. I don't remember anything after he hit the ball, to be honest. I don't have a great memory. You know, 6-2 game, I remember Henrik's chip, like everything. I even remember how I celebrated, how I ended up three rows further down. But this one's different. I remember him shaping up to shoot and then nothing. I don't remember, to be honest, seeing him celebrate the goal, you know, and seeing the scenes after it. It feels like I was watching it anew after he shapes up to it. And it's quite bizarre. You know, it's very specific in that I see him shape up and then that's how it stops, you know. So I don't really know. I don't know if anybody remembers what the celebrations were like.
Barry, can you talk the listeners through the actual goal itself?
So it's the one time where Valencia actually looked pretty ordinary and clumsy, because the cross comes in and it's not really cleared. The ball breaks. I think it's, is it Lambert that gives it to Volharen, and Volharen sort of stabs it through on the stretch. And the ball, just as Alan said, sits perfectly for Henrik, and he kind of sweeps it in. See, when you see it, it looks like it's going by the post, and I remember at the time thinking it was going wide because it was down my end as well. And I'm sort of different from that. I can remember, I always think about when you see the ball in the net, because even when it's in the net, you're checking for offside or whatever, but just bedlam. And I can never remember, it's always great when you go back at home after a game and you see the players celebrating, because at that moment in time, you're not looking at the pitch, you're just immersed in the people around you. I mean, my dad would have been jumping up and down, and just no more than we deserved. And I've said a few times, and I think I've referenced this goal, the time it comes at, I remember clearly, we sang all through half-time, and that's maybe happened maybe a handful of times, certainly less than 10 times in my life that I can remember the whole stadium singing at half-time. And it was just because it was new then, and as I say, it's rare, it felt like something special was happening, because if the crowd are so happy at half-time, you can only imagine what it was like when we came out for the second half, because we hadn't stopped singing, and it was just a perfect goal at the perfect time, as Sormani said, and no more than we deserve for our play, because we were fantastic.
To me, in terms of, I was in the Jockstein, so I was looking at Larsson's goal like straight ahead, and he hits it so early, and he hits it with such... this is going to sound weird because he's a striker and it's Larsson, but he hits it with such confidence that, you know, because as you know, as we talk about Cannizzaro's, he's got a big frame, he's long, so when he's stretching, it covers quite a lot of ground. But the technique is really odd, how he hits it. It spins round, and I remember the elation of the stadium. It was almost like we'd all been waiting for this, but we all weren't sure that it was going to come. It's like we hit the promised land of equalising within this tie at the perfect time, because there's a full second half left where it's like, right, anything can happen, which was daunting and scary, but also a massive, massive opportunity. The second half, Chris, thoughts on the second half and how we performed?
It wasn't like the first half. I mean, going back to just before we kind of start talking about the second half, there's sometimes when you want half time to come in, and there's other times when you maybe don't. And when we got that goal, and you could feel that re-energised, it kind of almost lit that touch fuse again. And, you know, I don't remember us singing through the half time. It's weird about that, but I don't, you know, I can understand why, because of where we were and what the atmosphere was like in that evening. But I think in terms of the second half, I think there had been, it wasn't as fast-paced, obviously, and we'd expended a lot of energy and it kind of settled down. At that, I think we conceded a few more chances and things like that.
Yeah,
Alan had touched on it earlier on as well. Lubo came off fairly early. I don't know, was it
55 minutes,
and we brought Silla on. I remember feeling a bit more nervous in the second half, because although we were one up, it doesn't matter because of the away goal, and that kind of, you know, the fear factor, that never dipped. But I do think, I still think we played really well in the second half, but not to the level that we did in the first half. And they seemed far more dangerous in my mind in the second half. It just seemed as if, wait a minute, we might come unstuck, because this team have got real quality. We've proven our worth so far, but as much as we've got the goal, it's almost like we switched from being the underdogs to having something to defend at that point. And I think you could see that a wee bit in the side, and we started to become a wee bit more dogged as opposed to swashbuckling, I would say.
Hey, Alan?
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's the mindset has changed, because when you do score that goal, you then have something to lose, because the aim of the night would have been to score a goal, quite simply. You know, obviously not concede, but when you then score a goal, the narrative changes, because you go from having nothing to lose because you're already out, you know, as it stands, to now, well, if we lose a goal, then, you know, that's going to be we'd need to score two. So it does figure that you would do that. You know, we did still play well, and we created some really good opportunities in the second half. But as you say, it became, I would say, a more accepted and traditional narrative of a game of, you know, a bit of to and fro. Valencia didn't look, they didn't have that same fear in terms of, they were able to move the ball more comfortably without pressure. You weren't breaking up their attacks quite quickly, and that's going to happen. You know, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that, but I think that comes from at halftime. I think Martin O'Neill would then have to adapt it and say, we can't play here like it's the last 45 minutes of football, because that's naive, and you are at parity now. If we can go and win the game, great, but by the same token, it would be a huge disappointment if we lost a goal in that second half, because, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult to go and score two. So I think the aim of it would have been to, I think Celtic would have been happy at full time to say, you know, we've won 1-0 and take it on, because that would have been, the away goal is massive, and it really is huge. So I think it figures, it's entirely natural almost that it would drop off, you know, despite the energy of the crowd, that there's a reality in it.
Yeah. Valencia start to pick passes a little bit more. Aymar starts to get on the ball a little bit more, which, as Alan says, and Sormani as well, Barry, these are world-class players. This is a world-class team. You can't expect that not to happen. It's just how Celtic react to that. There's no panic. There's no collapse. It's structured, and it probably is a case of, if we can nick something great here, if we can nick a second and win. However, let's just hold fast just now.
Yeah, it's also about keeping them at bay and containing them. And I think, as you mentioned, Aimar was... You really, people talk about the great names that we've seen at Celtic Park, and Aimar's maybe not at the very top level, but what a player he was. He had that sort of slight, sort of classic Argentinian type player, and he had a good chance maybe for the edge of the box in the second half. And that's only natural because of the intensity that we started with, and as Alan said, because we got the goal, the whole mindset of both teams changes then. And it was a mature performance, I think, in the second half from Celtic. Obviously, we'll come on to talk about the chances that we had, but it just adds to the spectacle of how we were able to sort of readjust, keep them at bay, and when they did have chances, not panic. And it was just a sort of polished European performance.
Just to take it out of context a little bit, is this the best European performance you've seen at Celtic Park, Chris Romani?
Best? I mean, watching it back, I was surprised at the quality. So it's weird you saying that, because you normally go to games and then you might watch highlights again, and then you, after that, you're only going to watch the goals, aren't you, and the key moments. So you maybe don't have as great an appreciation of it. But in my head, my favourite's probably still Leon at Celtic Park, because... We talked about it earlier on about kind of punching above our weight. That night, I kind of felt like we didn't. It kind of felt like we were just a really good European side and we beat them. So in my head, that almost seemed, it probably was a false dawn in terms of where we were. But I really liked, there was a kind of a nonchalance to us that night that we were just
there.
We could. Yeah, that's the level we're at. You know what I mean? It wasn't like we were kind of, you know, playing out of our skin. That night, it was almost just like, this is our level, this is our quality. Here's a routine 2-0 win. So it may be not the best, it was great in retrospect, but the Leon game for me is one that I'll always hold in that. But I might, if we can go back and watch that at a later date, we'll maybe see if my memory's playing tricks on me.
Alan, what the kind of highlights from the second half? Have you picked out anything?
Yeah, I think, you know, fairly obvious, but, you know, Henrik Larsson has what to him would be a pretty fairly basic opportunity, you know. It's quite funny because obviously in the first half, it's ruled offside, but Henrik does have a tap-in, essentially, against Canizares, and he doesn't lift the ball. You know, it is fine because it is offside. I think Mravchik's offside, but he squares it across to Henrik on his right foot, and he just stabs it right at Canizares, who saves it. But in the second half, the chance is a little bit different. He does have to dig it out a little bit. It's on his left foot, but he's got the whole goal to aim at. You know, it's for a player of Henrik Larsson's quality, it's quite simply, he's got to score, I would say. I don't know if maybe people might contest that because it is in his left foot and he does have to dig it out. But when you compare the quality of the goal that he scored with the opportunity that he has, you can't help but looking back on it and saying that it is probably a watershed moment. I mean, Sports Scene could have maybe covered that and said if Henrik scores that, then Celtic go 2-0 up. And I think with O'Neill's team, the way they were playing on that night, it's very difficult to say, but if they had gone 2-0 up, if Henrik does score that chance, it is very difficult to see where Valencia would get the momentum and the energy from. Obviously, the game is turned because then their aim is different, but it's very difficult to see how you would conspire to throw that away in that circumstance. And, well, it is difficult. You know, Henrik Larsson is the greatest City player I've ever seen. There's without doubt. But, you know, he did miss chances. You know, we'll come on to them. We'll come on to another really good opportunity he has. But I think it's difficult to see how you can't pinpoint that as a key moment in the game that passes by, quite simply.
Barry?
I was just going to say, see the chance that Alan's talking about. The skill from Alan Thompson, it's one of those things that... It's a weird noise, and hopefully you guys know what I'm talking about, but see when that happens and you hear the noise of the seats hitting off?
Yeah.
like the whole stadium. It's just, it goes silent and all you hear is that noise because everyone's standing up to see it.
But you hear it in stages as well, don't you? Because obviously different people at different elements. So it's a, it just kind of reverberates around. I know exactly the sound you mean.
And it's, I remember I always, when I first started going to games, I was like, what the fuck is that? It's like, is that a thunderclap or something? But it's one of those moments where, because everyone's trying to get the best vantage point, and I think, again, we mentioned the Lobo chance, how you were so confident a player of that quality would take it, even more so with Larsson from, what, 6-7 yards out, even maybe even less than that. And it's just unfortunate. But the play from Thompson was absolutely incredible, and sometimes that's forgotten about, that he had that in him. I think of, he did a similar bit of play at Ibrox that time he scored with his right foot, where he almost waits for the defender to draw in and then he kind of jinks past him. But again, it showed you the quality we had if Thompson came off the bench to do something like that.
Sir Manny?
I mean, you guys have covered it well, and I remember, I know exactly what you know by the seats clacking up there, Barry. You can almost hear it in your head when you say it. But for me, about the chance was the lack of conviction. I mean, it was very unlike Larsson. Now, it was slightly behind him, so he kind of had to dig back on him. So if you're wanting to be kind or whatever. But see, when you see it, he doesn't really go at it with, you know, force or conviction. You know, and that's the thing that kind of, I don't know, I mean, it would have been a hard, this was late in the game, it would have been a hard shift, and so, I don't know if the mind was willing and the body wasn't. Maybe I'm making excuses because it's Henrik Larsson and that's what he's doing. But he swings his foot at it and you're just thinking, you know, that you didn't, daft to say you didn't want it, but you just think, all you need to do is, see if he'd done what Lubo had done and just smashed it. There's every chance it would have gone in, but he didn't. He just kind of swung about at it. And when you look back at it, it really was quite feeble in one of those sliding doors moments, because I think we'd have won the UEFA Cup that season.
Jesus, oh my goodness.
I like the idea that we've rewritten this, and now in Henrik's head he was thinking, if I get another chance, I'm just going to put my foot through it. And boy, does he.
Jeez, oh. So we go into... The game finishes in terms of the 90 minutes. It's one each. It's been a frenetic and fantastic game of football, but everyone's drained. Oh, sorry, Barry, you want to say something?
I was just going to say, and this is going to make a mockery of myself because of what happened many years later, but I always remember the guy in front of me and his wee boy left at full time. Like, I remember thinking, where the fuck have they gone? And I like to think that they maybe went to stand with a pals further down the stand, but I really hope they didn't go home. And I know the point I referenced was when we played Dunfermline a couple of years back. I left not knowing it was going to extra time, so the joke's on me, but at least I never missed extra time and penalties against Valencia.
Let's talk about extra time. Alan, talk me through extra time.
That drained feeling, I think, and the dynamics of the game then, I think, weigh heavily on everybody. I don't know what... I remember, as I said, Henrik's moment, and I remember penalties. I don't have live recollections of extra time. You know, I think probably would have been the first time I was ever at a game that went extra time, I'm thinking. That's just off the top of my head. Certainly at Celtic Park, anyway. And it's difficult because the fear then sets in at that stage. I don't know what it would be like for players, but you know that any mistake, if you're the one that makes the mistake, it's difficult as well because you then your goal is to go into a situation in penalty shootouts where actually that becomes even more of an issue. You know, it becomes then more personal. It's one man it's down to. But extra time, you know, looking back at it today, it did seem... It was very, very cagey. It was almost like a different game of football, you know, to be honest. And it was an appendage to what was a great fixture, but in my opinion anyway, it didn't match up with the 90 minutes.
Chris?
It's funny you say that was the first game you might have been that went to extra time. First one out was at the Aberdeen Cup final in 1990. just wanted to get that Celtic da phrase out there. I was there. No,
sorry to interrupt somebody, but see, I was thinking this when you said this earlier. See, obviously the 90s has obviously long been the standard bearer for a shambles.
Yes.
Do you think that has now been usurped? Do you think it is now this season?
The 20s.
That we've just gone through. Do you think that is now the benchmark of you don't know what it's like? You weren't there in 2020.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to take that to the pools panel with Bowd and Gal before we find But there might be a changing in the guard here. But the point I was making is that I'd been a few games that went to extra time. But see, when it goes to extra time and the away goals still count, that doubles it, you know, because, you know, you'd need two, and there's no way we were getting two in that. So I don't remember much about that at the game as well, in terms of my actual recollection of it, other than the nervousness creeping in. And the thing is, I hate, and obviously we're going to talk about it very shortly, I hate penalty shootouts when Celtic are involved. They're a great spectacle when Celtic aren't involved, because I quite like the drama of it. But when Celtic are involved, I immediately assume that they're going to lose, and but it's perverse because you're in a position where you're thinking, would you take penalties just now because of that risk? And all I remember at the time was that horrible, horrible feeling that just permeates your body, thinking, fuck, what do I want? Would I rather they just kill it off just now, or do we want to go to penalties? I don't know. So in those circumstances, it's just a horrible watch and a horrible environment to be in.
Barry?
Yeah, that's the point I was going to make about away goals. I think that's a really unfair rule, because it's a disadvantage for the home team for an extra 30 minutes. I think they should scrap that.
They were talking about scrapping it, but it never came through.
Yeah, so it is that double-edged sword that I'm the same, I absolutely hate penalties. But it seems the lesser of two evils at that point, because you know if they score, that's pretty much over anyway. In terms of the extra time, I think Hartson had the one main chance, didn't he? Just
he pokes it, yeah.
I don't know. I think Canizares maybe touches it around the post, or it was going wide anyway. You're just thinking a wee bit more sort of composure, especially from a substitute, when it could have made all the difference. But penalty shootouts, I think it's, I'm the same as Alan. I think it's the first penalty shootout that I'd seen, and you just tend to think the worst. I think that's maybe a good way of going into it, because
There was a penalty shootout in 1994. I don't know if you remember that, pal. Fucking hell.
Yeah, well, I mean, being that live. Sorry, okay, being that live.
I'm sorry, yeah. Barry. That was the dickest thing to say.
This is from a Paul McStay fan.
Alan?
I mentioned earlier, obviously watched the full game, extra time and penalties, you know, the full shootout on YouTube, but there's also fan footage of it as well, which at 2001 must have been pretty cutting edge. Were video phones a thing?
No, 2001? Not in 2001, no.
So it must be somebody with an old camcorder.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the stewards now? You'd be in cuffs. But anyway, the point I'm making is that it was Paul Lambert obviously goes to take the first penalty, and I won't talk about his penalty, but the whole stadium is singing Oasis, Roll With It. Like, I mean, word for word, verse, everything. And he's walking up with the ball to put in the penalty spot. And I don't know, it's just, maybe it's just me, but I was thinking the whole time, like, obviously that's you're singing like a chart song, which is quite unusual. I know it wasn't unusual then, and Daft Punk obviously was massive under in kind of years to come. But I just thought Paul Lambert walking up with the ball, all that pressure, first penalty. Yeah, imagine I'm just walking up thinking, I fucking hate Oasis. I can't believe 60,000 are fucking singing it at me and I can't go them. Oh. It's a really personal thing, but just an aside.
See, on Lambert hitting the first penalty, I had no recollection of that, because my first thought when I watched it back was, fucking hell, Paul Lambert hit the first penalty. And, you know, you normally would think, get somebody who's maybe got a bit of a record, put some money in the bank, shall we say, with somebody who's going to be cool under pressure. But it just hit me as a strange one, being Paul Lambert. But,
was it because he was captain?
He probably just put himself forward. You're better taking the first and the last day if you're not a particularly good goal scorer.
Fuck off, Barry. Joking.
I don't even mean that, but
extra time, Larson has an opportunity, but, you know, gets stopped on the line. Douglas makes a good save from Carew, I think. It goes to penalties. How are you thinking? How are you feeling? I'll tell you how I was feeling. I was, I'd only ever seen Celtic in two penalty shootouts before, 94 and 90. I wanted them. And as soon as they started to formulate the kicker and the goalkeeper, I absolutely, the blood drained out of my entire face. And Barry, how are you feeling with the penalty shootout?
Just really nervous. The same point as Alan, the roll with it thing, it's so loud as well. Like, you must have been thinking, this is so off-putting. But fair play to Lambert. He slots that away. And it's that you start to like sort of go through many thoughts in your head, I think, penalty shootouts. You always think, is it better to go first? Is it better to go second? And you're trying to weigh it up against previous ones that you've seen, as you mentioned, Gal. And it's a cruel way to end a match, but I think the sort of spectacle of this match, it was only going to add to it, and you're just hoping that it would fall in our favour.
Lambert takes the first one, and he scores. It's a good penalty. John Carew steps up, he takes the second one, and he scores. Then Alan Thompson, dead ball specialist, no problem. Great penalty, terrific. Then Vicente steps up, and Chrissy misses. And at that point, you think, oh, here we go, because up steps Henrik Larsson.
Now, I'd read some of the news reports on the Celtic Wiki or some, I don't know where I read it, you know, it must have been the Celtic Wiki where they'd printed some of the newspaper stuff. See, when they refer to Henrik Larsson as being so deadly from 12 yards, I mean, this sounds like the slag Henrik Larsson show, you know, what with Alan sticking the boot in and now me saying that the guy was an absolute joke at penalties. But the one thing about Larsson was I never liked him hitting free kicks, and I was never confident with him with penalties. Now, he did score some big penalties for him. It wasn't like you thought you're going to miss.
Yeah.
You just weren't sure. You didn't have the certainty that Decanio, for instance, did, or Sutton for a while. At one point, Sutton really, really missed a penalty for us. You know, there was guys who you were more confident in. Henrik was never, ever somebody who I had 100% faith in scoring a penalty. And when, you know, it was maybe alluded to in terms of just put your boot through it, but it wasn't like, I mean, you know, the penalty afterwards kind of redeemed him in terms of poor quality penalties, shall we say, but, you know, he missed by a country mile. And I mean, it's, you know, to score a goal of that quality, you know, you talk about Baggio at the World Cup, Italy were dragged by a half-fit Roberto Baggio in the 94 World Cup, but what did they remember? That he skied the penalty in the final. It's not quite like that for Henrik, because it was a UEFA Cup third round, but, you know, the sheer quality of the equaliser and then that penalty, the way that he missed it, you're just thinking, at that point, I'm thinking, maybe not.
We could have went three up, but Gonzalo de los Santos makes it, equalises essentially. Then Petrov steps up. Chris, Alan?
It is like, I'm trying to think of a kind of analogy that goes with it, but it's all going so well, you know. They miss, then Larsson, and even though you're still probably, I think with a penalty shootout, when the other team miss, you assume you're going to score. I think that's,
yeah,
you know, as much as I'm always negative going into it, you feel like you've got the upper hand. And I'm sure I read actually something about the first team that misses in a shootout. I think conversely, they actually have the higher success rate. Might need to check that, but it is incredible because Henrik misses, but you've still got that chance, you're still parity, and then Stan steps up and he almost does the identical thing to Henrik. You know, instead of putting it high, though, he just puts it well wide. I mean, he doesn't even clip the outside of the post. It's quite a feat doing that from 12 yards to not manage to even hit
the target
post. You know, we obviously think that there's kind of some other examples of that as well, but it just lashes at it. I mean, it's complete lack of control. Henrik's one. Henrik was never great at penalties, I think, because he never had that technique of being able to get power into the ball without it leaving the ground. And that's good. Penalty takers tend to be able to do that. Put their foot through it, but make sure the ball doesn't leave the ground. Henrik never, the amount of times Henrik hit penalties and it was at, you know, kind of just under hip height, it's kind of prime for a goalkeeper. And then Petrov just lashes at it wide of the, you know, Canizares' post. And I think the frustrating thing with both the penalties is that it's almost like you've given them a free pass because you've not made the goalkeeper save it. And I don't mean to sound, you know, that's another one of the cliches that Samani will be talking up for us, but you've got to make sure the goalkeeper saves it. You know, I think that's the thing that I think frustrates. You know, Rob Douglas, you know, makes a save. You know, it's not a great penalty, but he does make a save. Whereas, and then obviously, no spoilers, but he goes on to make another. Whereas we lash at the ball and it doesn't even, not to even clip the post is, it is criminal. I feel bad here because, you know, I'm slating Henrik, I'm slating Stan. You know, Lubo's a joke. He should have been out the club years before. But, you know, to not hit the target, I think, is criminal from 12 yards. And I think it maybe does highlight a wee bit of the emotion of the occasion. Petrov more so because he's still a young guy at this point. But, you know, two penalties, very quickly the air is almost going out the stadium because you've just not got any control over the ball.
Barry, I'll bring you in first then, Samani.
I was just going to say this is a watershed moment for the cynic because O'Neill's had it, Larson, Lubo, Petrov.
Samani?
I think, okay, no spoilers, but what happens next kind of takes the shine away from Larson, and not the shine, the blame away from Larson and Petrov. Petrov's, for me, seemed even worse than Larson's. I mean, it just, you're right, it's an absolute feat to do what he did in terms of setting it wide. I just, when I watched it back, I remember thinking, that's dreadful. But of course, I mean, again, you said no spoilers. We get back into it with another save from Douglas, and then I think the double miss is kind of saves the blushes a wee bit of Petrov and Larson.
Yeah, so essentially what happens is Petrov misses, Sanchez scores, Sutton scores, and it's the very last penalty, and Ayala steps up, and if Valencia score this, they go through. But they don't. He misses. It's a save by Douglas as well.
I think if Douglas hadn't saved it, I don't think it would have went over the line. I don't think it was enough power on the ball.
No, aye.
Awful penalty.
Awful. So we're into sudden death. Hartson scores. Pellegrino scores. And Barry upsets who's Val Haren. Talk us through it.
Yeah. And it's funny when it gets to that sort of sudden death or deep into a penalty shootout, and even when you're at the game, it's as if the players just appear from nowhere, the ones that are taking the penalty shootout. And when you see Yusuf Haren, you're thinking, oh, Jesus. But because we've had the get out of jail twice, you're thinking, surely to God now. And then you steps up, Canizares saves, and you're just gutted. But then the referee has noticed that he's come off his line. And we get another one. And you're thinking, this is like the lifeline of all lifelines, and he misses again. And I think we all just knew. I know they still had another penalty to go, but I think we knew that it's very rarely you miss three, actually four penalties in a penalty shootout and win. And just devastated. But as their final penalty, is it Mister? It steps up, which is ironic. you wish he had Mister. And it just genuinely gutted after it, because we'd put so much into it, and it's a cruel way to lose it, but particularly with three of your sort of star performers over the last 18 months or so, even more so for Larson, and for them to miss it, you're devastated.
They win 5-4. Val Haren misses twice, as Barry says. But everyone claps them off. Everyone's delighted in terms of just the performance. And it felt like a new dawn, Chris. It felt like even though this game was just a little bit too far, Valencia would go on to win the league in Spain. They would go on to win La Liga. So they were clearly an incredible team. Celtic would win the league by, what, 18 points, 103 points, 94 goals, Champions League. It was the start of what would become the team that would get to the Seville final.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not, people talk about the atmosphere in the game and winning it, and they were a big team, but I don't think people talk about that and as much as in their major European memories. Well, they do them maybe, but it's never up there as the peak, as the best one or anything like that. But I think when you revisit it like this, you realise, you know, it was an important juncture because of the quality, because of what they had done, because we had for so long been a joke in Europe. You know, it probably would have fueled belief in terms of what we can or what we, you know, where we're going to go after that. I think we got some of that from the initial Champions League group stage, obviously, but that, for then, it was like a hell of a draw, and we went that close, and for me, it was really fun to look over again, you know, because you get wrapped up in the results and the memories and thinking back, but when you actually look at it in a wee bit more depth, you know, you start to reevaluate some of your thoughts on players overall, Neil Lennon being one. I mean, this is really redressing this. Maravchik's an absolute arse. Larsson's just in Petrov. But Neil Lennon is a top class European midfield player. But, you know, it was good to go back and see that. It was good to go back and see the level that we were able to perform at that time, you know. It wasn't... Martin O'Neill's team kind of gets sometimes kind of looked back upon as just this kind of big physical lumbering unit that kind of battered teams down, and that was it. There was some real, real quality footballers on that side. And Alan said that he summed it up early on. It was just a great game of football to watch back again.
Alan, final thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think I've got anything more to add in the game, but I loved watching it. It was great to watch a game like that out of context. And I would recommend that people go and watch it. It's a really great... Some of the memories that it brings back, you know, in terms of your own recollections of being there is quite vivid, and I think that the points that have been made about, you know, some of the players as well are really, really valid. It was cracking, a really great game of football, and you know, it's maybe for other people to discuss where it sits in the pantheon of European football. Just as a wee aside as well, the advertising hoarding, it marked a landmark occasion for the East End of Glasgow, as the B&Q warehouse had recently opened, as the main stand advertising hoarding said that there's a B&Q warehouse now open at the Ford Retail Park, and, you know, look at it now, quite simply, look at it now, thriving.
Thriving, look at it now. Barry, final thoughts?
Yeah, it was, as both the boys have said, it was a real joy looking back on it, and I think... Obviously, the sadness of going out, but you came away with a real pride, and it only whetted the appetite for future involvements in Europe, which we went on to do. And yeah, brilliant performance. I still maintain it's the best atmosphere that I've seen, but in terms of the performance, I couldn't remember how good we'd played. And it'll be interesting to see the sort of stats approach look at it, to see if it was as enjoyable as we remember it.
Absolutely. Final word goes to Martin O'Neill, who said after the game, "We have come a long way and we have discovered a taste for it all, so I hope we can improve at this level in the future." Spoilers, we do. Chris Armani, Alan Edgar, Barry Gallagher, thank you very much. That was fantastic. I'm Chris Gallagher, and this has been Focus On Celtic 1, Valencia 0, 2001.